Next up, a discussion with Jason Leopold on John Kiriakou and the torture of Abu Zubaydah.
Waterboarding was one of the techniques.
Yes. And was it used on Zubaydah?
It was.
And was it successful?
It was.
What happened as a result of that?
He resisted. He was able to withstand the waterboarding for quite some time, and by that I mean probably 30, 35 seconds.
That's quite some time.
Which was quite some time. And a short time afterwards, in the next day or so, he told his interrogator that Allah had visited him in his cell during the night and told him to cooperate because his cooperation would make it easier on the other brothers who had been captured. And from that day on, he answered every question just like I'm sitting here speaking to you.
In a willing way?
In a willing way.
So in your view, the waterboarding broke him?
I think it did, yes.
And did it make a difference in terms of...
It did. The threat information that he provided disrupted a number of attacks, maybe dozens of attacks.
No doubt about that? That's not some hype?
No, no question.
All right, we're joined with Jason Leopold here to discuss his interview with John Kiriakou. Now, for those of you who haven't had a chance, go to Truth Out. We'll send you a link in the article where Kiriakou addresses a, I would call a recantation of his interview with Brian Ross on ABC. So first, let's play this introduction to your interview.
We now know that he wasn't, in fact, involved in 9/11.
Correct.
Is that...
That's my understanding as well. We thought he had been involved in a lot of different things. We were really not sure what intelligence was correct and what was incorrect. I think we got ourselves really excited at the possibility that he may have been involved in 9/11, and we went out looking for him. I remember being told at the time that he was the hub of the wheel, that all the spokes went out from Abu Zubaydah to terrorist cells all around the world. He was a logistics guy. He knew everybody. He was actively involved in training by leading the larger of Al-Qaeda's two training camps in Afghanistan. And we were always told that if he wasn't involved in specific attacks, he would know who was involved and he would be able to lead us to those people.
So when Kiriakou said this, how does that jive with the official record now?
Oh, it's vastly different, as I, had mentioned in the interview. I mean, Abu Zubaydah is a person who, even before 9/11, intelligence officials, notably Richard Clark, had been saying was a major figure in Al-Qaeda, who was involved in the Millennium bomb plot in Los Angeles, who was involved in activities revolving around attempts to blow up hotels in Jordan. We had been told well before the 9/11 attacks that Abu Zubaydah was, a major figure.
Go ahead. We learned about him first through Ahmed Ressam. Is that correct?
We did. And in fact, yes, he was the... the one who was apprehended as the individual who was going to, launch an attack or a bomb plot at Los Angeles Airport. And, in that infamous presidential daily brief, I believe it's dated August 6, 2001, tight under the subject line, Bin Laden determined to strike in the U.S., the one that gave Bush, George Bush, the early warning that an attack was looming, one that he took no action on nor did anything about. Abu Zubaydah was identified in there and was identified in, in connection with I believe, the Millennium Plot. But he was more or less, identified as somebody who was, planning and plotting these attacks. And, the public had been told that after he was captured that we captured, one of the top Al-Qaeda figures. And, in fact, the entire torture program was designed around him. He is identified in the torture memo of August of 2002 as being someone who was a planner of 9/11, involved in every major terrorist operation for the past, decade, if not longer, that he was the number three person in Al-Qaeda, that he was bin Laden's lieutenant. So certainly the message that was disseminated was that here was someone that was captured, that was a big fish, and he had a lot of information about pending terrorist attacks or impending terrorist attacks, and he was not giving up that information, and therefore we needed to torture him. And what John Kiriakou said in this interview, which is important for the people who continue to maintain that Abu Zubaydah is this major figure, and those people include former Bush speechwriter Mark Thiessen, Dick Cheney, Liz Cheney, for all the individuals who continue to support this, these allegations. What was important is that Kiriakou said that's not true, that in fact he wasn't, someone who planned 9/11. He wasn't someone who was the, top Al-Qaeda figure. In fact, he even makes an important distinction. He says that he never swore allegiance to Al-Qaeda in this interview.
He admitted that he knew about 9/11 in advance, but he did not, to the best of my knowledge, have a role in 9/11.
And that's really important because those who are, involved in, this terrorist organization swear, allegiance to Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, and Abu Zubaydah did not. So, it's important that he disclosed that, and he disclosed it on the record, and he disclosed it, publicly for everyone to hear. I think that it absolutely undercuts the, assertions by former Bush administration officials, who are still looking to, protect themselves and the fact that they were either lying, which I think is certainly the likely scenario, or just plain got the intelligence wrong.
Let's listen to what he said about that. That was an interesting comment he made. I think you caught him unawares of the thought there. Hold on.
I wonder if the reason why the government is not seeking a death penalty case, or not seeking a death penalty sentence against him, is because they were wrong in the beginning about his importance, and they've come to realize that he just wasn't involved in a lot of these operations that they had previously believed.
And again, in this document, the government says that it has not contended in this proceeding that petitioner Abu Zubaydah had any direct role or advanced knowledge of the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001.
That's interesting to me. Because that's certainly not the information that we had been given in 2002.
Well, then how are you getting your information?
Right.
Which I thought was a very good question.
He basically said that he was getting it from a variety of sources. But again, look, this is, let me just give, in terms of background, provide, you with a little insight. The document I have been reading from was a little-known document that was recently declassified, and this is the opposition motion for discovery, and it's basically opposing Abu Zubaydah's defense counsel request for specific evidence that would support the government's reasons for holding him. This is in regard to his habeas corpus challenge. And in this document, you could tell that the defense counsel had asked for specific evidence. Well, tell us if you have evidence that, he's involved in 9/11, which is what you previously claimed. And tell us that you have evidence that he knew of, terrorist attacks, which is what you previously claimed. And basically those two important, what I zeroed in on are two important pieces of information in this document that the government, in their response, said that we make no claims that he, had any knowledge of impending terrorist attacks. In fact, we don't make any claim that he knew about 9/11. or any other terrorist, you know, attack. So, you know, Kiriakou, I think, was, you know, hypothesizing as to, you know, why the government was not seeking that death penalty case against him, or any other charges at this point, for that matter, last November, when we, you know, discovered that, or rather when we were told that Attorney General Eric Holder was made a decision about Khaled Sheikh Mohammed and you know, other 9/11 co-conspirators, as well as the alleged mastermind of the 9/11 of the of the USS Cole bombing, al-Nashiri. You know, and left off that list was Abu Zubaydah. You would think that someone who the government, you know, claimed was involved in all these activities would obviously be charged with something. So, you know, I think that's an important, you know, what he said in this in his response is important. That's not the information we had been given. And I think that the Bush administration, two things. They like I said, they either knew that the intelligence was flawed and they needed to catch someone, or they just had no information about Al-Qaeda and they needed someone to provide that information. So who best to, you know, get that information? The guy who is always on the phone. You know, that's the thing about Abu Zubaydah, is that he was always on the telephone. He's not somebody who was, you know, behind the scenes in an operative capacity, you know, planning these things. And that's part of the reason why, you know, he was never given any sort of real responsibility. Now, let me also say that, you know, he made some claims there about running out Al-Qaeda's two training camps in Afghanistan. That's actually false because, again, in the government's motion, they admit, or they at least say they don't contend, that those training camps were Al-Qaeda training camps. In fact, they were shut down because he refused to turn them into Al-Qaeda training camps.
Now, let me ask you this, because see, in the testimony of Abu Zubaydah, there's a portion where his translator does a lot of speaking, but then clear sections where he does speaking in the language is very interesting. He basically said he ran Khaldun Camp and that Osama bin Laden wanted to take over Khaldun Camp and any other camp and create one big camp system,
right,
and one big jihad. Is that consistent with the government's filings now?
Actually, it's not something that the government says. They don't go into that much detail. All this information remains, you know, classified or redacted. Basically, they're just saying that you know, they don't contend that these were Al-Qaeda training camps. You know, they don't go into further detail. But if you put that together with what he said during his, I believe it's his combatant status review, you know, tribunal hearing,
right,
it more or less falls into place. So again, you know, someone like John Kiriakou, you know, perhaps had been given this intelligence from Langley about, you know, Abu Zubaydah, and had been told that he's a very important asset, important intelligence asset, and that he needed to be captured. And by the way, that's the thing. They needed to capture him. They didn't want to kill him, even though they, you know, he was shot and he was, you know, during the course of his capture, and he nearly died. He was an important piece of intelligence that they needed so the administration could obtain information from Al-Qaeda. What's really striking is that the FBI, you know, major, you know, figures in the FBI, such as Dan Coleman, Jack Clunan, these, you know, special agents who worked in the Bin Laden unit, they had long maintained for years that Abu Zubaydah wasn't the, you know, person that the Bush administration later claimed he was. So it just shows you how disconnected, you know, the even after 9/11, the intelligence agencies were. There was still a, you know, what I would refer to as a non-working relationship. The intelligence sharing was just not going on. And if it was, it was just ignored. So, you know, this administration needed some information. And I believe that they, you know, they knew that there wasn't any, you know, pending terrorist attacks. They just, you know, set up this torture program just to get them to give up some names and numbers and, you know, and things like that. And certainly, you know, the information that he did give, at least on individuals, led to, you know, their capture. Currently, the government is wiping in their filings, they're wiping out any reference to Abu Zubaydah. They're basically, you know, in cases where, you know, the capture of certain individuals came as a result of information supplied by Abu Zubaydah, they're no longer, you know, using that as the basis for holding these other folks.
Now, how is that different than the Qahtani case? Because that's kind of what's happening in that case, is it not?
It is. I think with, you know, with people like Al-Qahtani and even Zubaydah, I mean, the important thing to keep in mind is that they tortured the, you know, the heck out of them. They were brutally tortured. So it gets to the point where they were so brutally tortured that they can no longer just say, well, you're free to go. But at the same time, they can't even say, we have a case against you. But what it does is that it does undercut the veracity of the government's, you know, claims, and it certainly punches a hole in the evidence that they, you know, that they have. So, you know, with somebody like Al-Qahtani, who was just, again, you know, just tortured, they really can't do anything. They don't have anything that they can, you know, bring to the forefront. And again, you know, the Al-Qahtani, I believe he was, you know, one of the latest 20th hijacker. You know, there's so many 20th hijackers of 9/11. You know, I'm not sure if that's actually, you know, something that the government either maintains or, you know, will push forward with. Because he was, you know, someone that they were seeking the death penalty against. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Susan Crawford, who presided over the, you know, tribunals, or the chief judge over at Guantanamo, you know, she made that revelation to Bob Woodward. We tortured Al-Qahtani, and therefore she would not allow any, you know, evidence to be presented that would allow the government to move forward with, you know, their prosecution. So they, you know, they withdrew the, you know, the death penalty. So it just makes it much more difficult, obviously, for them to present any case because it's all tainted by torture.
Well, let's take a second to listen to there's this one portion with Sheldon Whitehouse asks Ali Soufan about the president's narrative.
On September 6, 2006, President Bush stated the following.
Within months of September the 11th, 2001, we captured a man named Abu Zubaydah. We believe that Zubaydah was a senior terrorist leader and a trusted associate of Osama bin Laden. Zubaydah was severely wounded during the firefight that brought him into custody, and he survived only because of the medical care arranged by the CIA. After he recovered, Zubaydah was defiant and evasive. He declared his hatred of America. During questioning, he had first disclosed what he thought was nominal information and then stopped all cooperation. We knew that Zubaydah had more information that could save innocent lives, but he stopped talking. As his questioning proceeded, it became clear that he had received training on how to resist interrogation, and so the CIA used an alternative set of procedures.
Does that statement by the president accurately reflect the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah?
Well, the environment that he's talking about, yes, it reflects, you know, he was injured and he needed medical care. But I think the president, my own personal opinion here, based on my recollection, he was told probably half-truth.
And repeated a half-truth, obviously. His statement as presented does not conform with what you know to be the case from your experience on hand.
Yes, sir.
I'm over my time. Senator Graham.
There's more he says after this. Defiant and evasive. Now, Kiriakou described him, and I believe Soufan described him as a fairly well-tempered person. Isn't that pretty consistent?
Yeah, in fact, you know, Kiriakou said that after he awoke from the coma, you know, he, you know, aside from the claims that he asked him to, you know, smother him with a pillow, he was lucid. He was talkative. He was, in fact, what's really funny is if you listen to Kiriakou, he actually says he was talking to him. He's very open. So that's sort of, you know, obviously he wasn't being interrogated at that point.
Right.
It's pretty well established that he was not defiant and evasive, that here's the thing, he just didn't know anything. He certainly didn't know anything about any, you know, pending terrorist attacks, because, you know, first of all, the government no longer makes any claim that he does, at least in his habeas corpus proceeding. Any defiance, you know, was certainly not as a result of withholding information. It was just a matter of he wasn't telling the torturers what they wanted to hear. It's also interesting that, you know, Bush says that, you know, after he was captured, he was defiant and evasive. You know, the torture memo was issued in August of 2002. So he was captured on March 28th, 2002, brought to a black site in early April. So, you know, if you were to believe Bush, he was, what, defiant and evasive for 5-6 months, 4 months, and then tortured? I mean, you know, for someone who, you know, for an administration that claimed that, you know, we were under, this was a ticking time bomb scenario, they certainly... it suggests that they, you know, they waited quite a while, but it, you know, before they tortured him. But what we do know is that he was tortured very early on. I think that there's absolutely no question of that, and the documents certainly that have been released over the years support the, you know, support that, you know, what I'm saying right now in terms of he was subjected to numerous torture techniques that had not yet been, you know, legally approved, even though that they would still violate Geneva Conventions and would amount to torture. But of course, the, you know, the Bush administration and the lawyers there twisted the law. So,
well, do we have a sense of when Ali Soufan comes into this picture? Is it, we know he was
in
captured.
April.
Okay, he
it's
so this April. Came in April. This was within the six. This is roughly about 4 to 6 weeks after he was captured.
Ali Soufan was there, and he was captured on March 28th, 2002. He remained in Pakistan for a few days, maybe 4 or 5 days, taken to Thailand. Ali Soufan was pretty much, you know, one of the first guys on the ground there. From what I understand, at least in the black site. So he was... another FBI agent, you know, were there together. Godin, I believe it's Steve Godin. You know, they were both there together. So
here's Sheldon Whitehouse asks him about that incident. Let's hear what he has to say.
Let me ask you more specifically about the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah. You were present. Indeed, you're one of the first, if not the first, interrogators present when Abu Zubaydah was brought into custody for the first time outside of Pakistan, correct?
Yes, sir.
And then?
And your testimony indicates that within the first hour of your interrogation of him, you had gained important actionable intelligence. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
At that point, his condition was such that you indicated that we had to take him to a hospital or he would die. But at the hospital, you continued your questioning. and it was during your questioning of him at the hospital that you elicited information regarding the previously unknown role of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed as the mastermind of the 9/11 attacks.
Correct, sir.
One of the more significant pieces of intelligence information we've ever obtained in the war on terror, correct?
It's one of them, yes, sir.
Now, here's the next thing, because this is referring to the timeline. Now, he's saying this is before...
Yeah, let me correct myself. I mean, what he's saying then is that, is that he was actually at the hospital.
Right.
And I believe in Pakistan. So yes, he was, to correct myself, he was there, obviously, much earlier.
And actually, that would also correct Kiriakou, because he also said that, to the best of his knowledge, no one interrogated until well after that.
Right, right. Yeah, there's obviously some, discrepancies about specific, time frames. I think that it's, what is clear is that, yes, days, he was, Kiriakou was the guy on the ground who captured him, along with, 51 other, alleged terrorists that evening. And was one of the first, Americans to intelligence officers to speak with him. And so it's clear that at least from according to Savant's testimony, he was there as well. What's not clear is when Kiriakou left and what he what he saw between the time he started, whether he actually saw any real interrogation.
Lindsey Graham asked Soufan about Kiriakou.
About the interrogation of this suspect, do you know a gentleman named John Kiriakou?
Me? Yeah. Myself? The question? No, I don't know him.
Okay, he gave an interview.
And then he goes into the interview.
Yeah, with these guys, I think you have to be, at least what I've learned, is that he may not know him,
Right.
It doesn't answer the question as to whether they were there in the same room.
Right.
He asked a specific question. Do you know
him? Well, I mainly point out there would be no notable recollection, it would sound, from how short he made his answer. So,
right.
So after Soufan began to do the interrogation, he was interfered with by the contractors. Contractors began to give orders. Is that was his testimony? Is that your understanding elsewhere?
Yeah, that's actually my understanding as well. Is that, and I think it's pretty clear. We know that from books like Jane Mayer's The Dark Side. That what happened was that they were there. They were doing their they were conducting their interrogations using rapport building techniques, which is how they refer to it. That they claim he was giving up actionable intelligence, that the CIA found this out, George Tenet found this out, immediately, put a stop to it or at least sent in their own, intelligence folks, interrogators to take charge. They immediately sent these torturers in to take over the interrogations. And, it's important to keep in mind that this was something that was put into place, the torture program, the fact that the torturers were present very early on. This is not something that just happened at that time. It's something that, the CIA had the torture program, or at least had an idea of what they intended to do by the previous December. So, what's really important though, is that I asked Kiriakou in the interview, and I asked him specifically what his definition of actionable intelligence was, because he made that claim as well. And his definition of actionable intelligence is intelligence that would, save American lives. And, Soufan, says we got actionable intelligence about, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. I think there's still a little bit of a discrepancy, or at least an understanding as to, you know, whether that would constitute actionable intelligence. But more importantly, you know, it raises a question as to, you know, is he saying that the CIA and FBI just frankly had no idea who Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was? That would not actually support, you know, previous assertions by other officials that the CIA and FBI already knew who Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was. Perhaps they just didn't know. You know. So it's a question that really, you know, still needs to be asked. I mean, you know, that's the thing here is that we don't, you know, we're getting more pieces to the puzzle. You know, what's missing is what was happening in terms of the torture that was going on very early. Was any of that, you know, was any of that part of a bigger program, such as human experimentation? And I think that's a really important, it's a very important question because it's something that we're finding a little bit more evidence about, that there was a lot of data collection taking place, that Abu Zubaydah had been subjected to, you know, brutal techniques as a way of, so the torturers could collect information to measure stress levels. You know, that would allow them to, you know, to use it to torture others. So, in terms of, you know, what the real intelligence was that he gave up, that's something that we still don't know. You know, what do we hear? We're hearing that he gave up information about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. That certainly doesn't, you know, that's certainly not a that may be a big deal for the government. And in fact, that's, you know, he is a self-professed 9/11 mastermind, but certainly does not.
Yeah, but that in context, I'm not trying to throw out the government's argument. Just as a third-party witness, though, I watched a man just a couple of years ago confess to killing JonBenet Ramsey, and after media publicity all over the place, the guy finally was ruled a nut.
Right. Right.
I mean, he was thorough. I mean, I looked at the guy and said, yeah, I mean, I guess he could have. And later they said, well, no, he's a sensational hound, so.
Right. Well, I think that, yeah, I think that's a good point. And I think that, you know, the fact is that, you know, this program was set up because, you know, they as Dick Cheney said, we've got to take the gloves off. We're going to the dark side. You know, hence the title of Jane Mayer's book, you know, The Dark Side. They felt that, you know, they needed to torture this person for whatever reason. I find it, you know, I find that the facts do not support the support the notion that, you know, he had the intelligence that they needed, to thwart any sort of, you know, plots against, you know, pending plots against the U.S. or other interests. I think this was a far more sinister program and what they were conducting.
So to tie in Mr. Cheney into this narrative here, what do we know about, aside from OLC memos, what do we know about the, say, paper trail and or evidence trail leading from the vice president's office to these the application of these techniques?
Well, we don't know, you know, we do know that there was quite a bit of involvement and discussion and meetings that, you know, took place where the office of the vice president were deeply involved in this. In terms of, you know, the paper trail, we've seen that there are memos from David Addington and discussions, you know, about what, you know, what Addington was weighing in on. But we also know that Dick Cheney, you know, I think more importantly, has himself admitted that he signed off, you know, on the waterboarding of Zubaydah, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and al-Nashiri. And he said, as well as the torture of about 30 others. So here we have a vice president publicly admitting that he signed off, gave the green light, you know, to torture, war crimes. I don't think we need, you know, his own words.
This would be from starting in December 2009, when he, 2008, before Obama administration took over. He was on ABC, and then subsequently PBS and some others where he went fairly media hound.
Yeah,
on it.
He gave an interview to the Washington Times. So he admitted it. He admitted that he signed off. So in terms of the paper trail, I mean, I think that basically, if he's admitting this, it would be the right assumption to make that he was obviously, kept in the loop. He saw intelligence documents. He was, involved, and he was told certain, things that perhaps led him to, sign off on it. What we don't know is what he was actually told and what those documents say. They obviously remain classified, but the fact that at the time he was still the sitting vice president saying I signed off on this is explosive. And I should also just reiterate that he made the same statement a few months ago. So during an interview on ABC News, so Dick Cheney really went out there banging on his chest, saying this was, this was my baby, so to speak, and I I was behind it.
What about a Bush tie-in? Do we have something where he publicly went out and wagged his finger at everybody quite a bit? But do we have? Is he well tied into this, or does this fit the pattern where he is often used as kind of a puppet throwaway, where everything happens kind of in one office, and then he gets the brief of what to go out and say and does the cheerleader role?
I think that there's, I think what we know is that there was, Bush was perhaps purposely kept out of the, specific meetings that took place. So he wasn't physically there. I'm sure he was obviously briefed. And in fact, George Tenet had sought, some signatures from the president signing off on this. I'm not sure if there are any executive orders that exist. I think that that's still, a big question. Are there any executive orders, where Bush specifically signed off on torture, on, the waterboarding, or on anything else, for that matter? I think that we're able to say that, Bush was well aware of it. In fact, in James Risen's book, State of War, he discusses a conversation that took place between George Tenet and George Bush about Zubeda, and George Tenet, said that we have him on pain medication, and Bush said, who authorized that? Who authorized him being on pain medication? And then in Ron Suskind's book, he actually writes that during that same meeting, Bush asked, do some of these techniques really work? So clearly he was, being briefed about what was taking place. Whether there's a paper trail, I think that that remains to be seen. But I would guess that there is.
Now, bringing up Ron Suskind, there's an important side note to this, to the coverage, really, of the whole story, starting from when we first heard about this in September 2006 was when Bush went on his media press event and said this. And I believe it was really the next day when Suskind came out with his article. And there was this narrative that Abu Zubaydah was insane, and these, again, related to the diaries and doodle books. Can you give us some context of that?
Yeah, basically, Abu Zubaydah kept, kept diaries. From his time fighting, communists in Afghanistan, which is how his attorney describes it, up to the point where, he was in Guantanamo. And I believe there may be 10, there's three sets of diaries before he was captured, while he was in CIA custody, and then, after he was transferred to Guantanamo. So there's about 10 or 12 volumes. And the diaries were, according to Ron Susskind in his book, The 1% Doctrine, were evidence of the fact that he was mentally unstable, that he wrote in the from the perspective of three different personalities, that he, an older man, a young boy, and Abu Zubaydah, in his current state, so he wrote from three different points of view, perspective, and that even FBI Special Agent Dan Coleman, who got a look at these diaries, had said it was evidence that he was, quote, certifiable.
But this had a context, though. This was something he had been encouraged to do by his captors, basically? The doodle books, at least?
I'm not sure that he was actually encouraged to do it, because, here's something important to keep in mind. The government's entire case against Abu Zubaydah currently, the basis for their entire claims that he, or I should say, the government's evidence against Abu Zubaydah is based entirely on his diaries that were written prior to his capture. So he kept diaries before he was captured, or he kept a diary, and their entire case is based on those diaries. Whether he was encouraged to do so, after the fact, I'm not sure if it was actually encouraged, but it's something that he was just generally used to doing. So, that's very important. Basically, what the government is saying is that they don't, they're not claiming that they're not using any of the evidence they obtained after his capture to support their reasons for, his indefinite detention or in his habeas proceeding. They're using everything prior to his capture. So it obviously calls into question the evidence that he supplied after his capture. B, it calls into question, whether obviously all of that evidence was just tainted by torture, or if it was just frankly flawed. But, where there's a disagreement is what the diaries, whether it's a work of fiction or whether it's a true representation of his mental state. And according to the FBI and as Ron Susskind wrote, it was evidence of the fact that he was mentally unstable. John Kiriakou, disputes that. He says that it was a work of fiction. That in fact, the diaries were not, evidence of a man that was, as he describes it, retarded or insane or suffered from any mental condition. It was a creative outlet. And, Marcy Wheeler, who, is the prolific blogger, known as Empty Wheel, she had written she had blogged about the fact that, and made an important note that if the government is saying that the diaries are a work of fiction, if John Kiriakou is saying that the diaries are a work of fiction, then that actually means that the government would have to say, that the diaries are a work of fiction, or rather it calls into question, what they're stating. I mean, she made two important points, which I've unfortunately have mangled, but on one hand, if it is evidence that he is, mentally unstable, then in fact, that should, be, the evidence that the government is putting forth. Or if it is a work of fiction, then, it sort of throws a wrench into the government's entire, claims for holding him, because they're like I said, their entire case is based on the fact that, or their entire case against him currently is based on his diaries written prior to his capture.
There's one other aspect of this, as far as the official criminality of it. We have the CIA leak. I mean, the CIA tapes case that has been out for a while. And you asked Kiriakou about this, and I'll just play the brief last question about that when he is talked about Jose Rodriguez. One moment.
So you believe that it's just, frankly, one person involved in it with a few emails going back and forth?
I'm sure that there were other people who knew of the existence of the tapes, who knew what was on the tapes, and who urged Jose to destroy them.
So he basically says, one, the decision to make the tapes is by Rodriguez. Two, the decision to destroy the tapes is likely done by Rodriguez. Is that his account?
Yeah, that's what he's saying. And I mean, you know, Jose Rodriguez was his boss.
Okay.
He didn't have a good relationship with Jose Rodriguez, which he states. I think what's really important here is that, you know, John Kiriakou sort of came into the spotlight as a result of the destruction of the torture tapes. You know, a few days after the tapes were destroyed, you know, John Kiriakou appeared on ABC News discussing the, you know, waterboarding. He was brought onto the program because Brian Ross, the interviewer, had thought or was under the impression that Kiriakou knew something about the torture tapes. You know, Kiriakou told me in this interview that he actually didn't know anything about the, you know, the torture tapes. You know, what he disclosed, which became, you know, some explosive information there, at the time, was that, Abu Zubaydah broke after, you know, 30 to 35 seconds and gave up actionable intelligence. He based that information off of, a cable dated August 2002 that he had read, one cable. So, you know, I think what he's trying to say is that he did not know certainly about, you know, the torture tapes or the destruction. And frankly, I think he's just, you know, hypothesizing about what happened. Perhaps he knows a little bit more about the, you know, how these things would take place. But
well, and that, this would be a very interesting irony because, again, now we have a person who doesn't have firsthand knowledge like Abu Zubaydah, but he might have some sort of systematic knowledge that if we pressed for that systematic knowledge, we might understand something bigger.
Yeah, I think that it's, you know, there's a couple of important things to keep in mind. You know, these tapes were destroyed as Congress was making inquiries. These tapes were destroyed as the Washington Post disclosed the existence of CIA black site prisons, where the tapes were made, where the torture took place. So it certainly appears as if they were reacting to the fact that, you know, there was news coming out that eventually, you know, this would leak and perhaps, you know, there would be subpoenas issued. More importantly, however, there were already, you know, protective orders issued by, you know, federal court judges to maintain any evidence you know, if the CIA had any electronic or other evidence, you know, showing interrogation. So we already know that, you know, there was those orders issued in two cases, as a matter of fact. In fact, the interesting thing is that, you know, protective order was issued in Zubaydah's case as well in July of, I think it was 2005, just a, you know, months before the destruction of the tapes. So, or yeah, I believe that's the time frame. So, you know, there still remains the question as to why they were destroyed. And I don't buy the reason, certainly, and nor do I think anyone really does buy the reasons that the CIA had been giving, that they wanted to either protect the identities of the, you know, interrogators in the tapes, or that they wanted to, or that they no longer needed them, and there was, you know, they weren't even something that they needed for any other criminal trial involving any terrorists or alleged terrorists, which is, you know, false because, you know, these types of tapes were sought in the Moussaoui, Zachariah Moussaoui trial. So, you know, there's a lot of questions that remain. And hopefully John Durham, the special prosecutor in charge with investigating the destruction, will answer those.
Do we have any knowledge of whether or not the interrogations were actually carried out by third-party contractors? Entirely.
Oh, yeah, we definitely have that. I mean,
because we have objections from the FBI. Soufan was withdrawn from the scene.
Right.
We have objections from some CIA agents, including comments from Kiriakou, who say there were agents who were concerned and were seeking basically legal advice of being involved and were ultimately told, don't get involved if, you know, unless you want risks. And then there's this veil. And beyond this veil are potentially CIA agents who engaged in it and
right
contractors.
Yeah. I think there's no question that we know that there were contractors. I mean, Mitchell and Jessen, Jessen, James Mitchell, I mean, they were contractors. So
okay, but were they being brains? Or in other words, what I'm saying is, exactly, I'm making that point, is that they being maybe brains, but were they involved in being brawn? And if not, were they hiring brawn to come in and exactly?
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. And I think we've seen some evidence of that. I don't know exactly how much evidence is out there about that, because again, you know, let's remember, although there have been hundreds of thousands of documents that have been released over the years, thanks to the efforts of the ACLU to pry them loose from the government as a result of the Freedom of Information Act, there still remains, you know, quite a bit of information that's you know, that has not been disclosed. And even many of the documents that are released have been heavily redacted. So, you know, there's still a big question as to, you know, who was involved and, you know, what role, how big of a role did contractors play. I think that it would be safe to say that, yes, there were contractors.
And meanwhile, Abu Zubaydah languishes with no charges?
Yes, he continues to... you know, he's detained at Guantanamo. His attorneys have the most difficult task ahead of them in terms of trying to mount a defense, because you have a judge presiding over, you know, his habeas proceedings that refuses to rule on any motions, that every filing they make is immediately classified, that it's not declassified for months, in some cases years. In some cases, not at all. The government has abused the classification system. So, you know, it's for them, it's obviously very difficult to, you know, to mount any sort of defense. But, you know, I think that they've been successful in at least helping to change the narrative quite a bit about who he was, what was happening. And I think Kiriakou, you know, although his, you know, some of his assertions seem to be questionable, I think some of the statements that he has made, you know, help change that narrative quite a bit. And, you know, that really undercuts further, as I said, you know, in the beginning of our conversation, further undercuts assertions made by folks like Dick Cheney, Mark Thiessen, that, you know, this person, Abu Zubaydah, was a key, you know, al-Qaeda figure in terms of the number three person. You know, let me just say that the government is certainly not saying he was a nobody. I mean, they're making...
Abu Zubaydah doesn't say he's a nobody.
Right. He doesn't say that at all. He certainly...
But he does say that our fight was with Russia over Chechnya. We thank you for your... He thanked the Americans for the involvement in Bosnia. We were good on those days. He criticized our relationship with Israel. And otherwise, I believe, reading his narrative, his testimony, he said, that's it.
Yeah. I think what's really important to keep in mind is that, you know, is what we were told. And if you just focus on that, you know, 9/11... the number three person in al-Qaeda, the fact that he was tortured, that the torture program was built around the fact that he had evidence, or intelligence rather, that he was not supplying, that really, you know, pokes holes in the you know, assertions and claims and allegations and that the government, that the Bush administration had been making over the years, and which the public still believes. So, you know, that's why I think it's very important to change that narrative.
Right.
Not to say that, you know, he is a innocent person who, frankly, was just picked up, you know, as so many other detainees in Guantanamo who are you know, innocent. But, you know, what we were told is absolutely wrong.
I didn't see, just in closing comment here, I didn't see really a hair's breadth difference between what he described as his role in Calden Camp, where he said he's not there to play fanatical games with people. He was there to train people for a particular purpose. And I don't see that as very different than, say, Blackwater, training in the U.S. or training in the hills of different states here in the U.S. When they run around with their machine guns and play fake military games when they're not a portion of the military. So,
right. I think that, you know, certainly with Blackwater, they're, you know, they've got a government contract and, you know, they're fighting, you know, well, first of all, they're supporting the, you know, military and their, and in fact, the CIA, as we now know, and in their fight, you know, in the war on terror.
But this idea of this construction camp, I mean, Eric Prince has this big old camp of his own where people get to come out and train in paramilitary. We have things like the School of Americas where we train foreign fighters to go back, send them back and do this. So my understanding of his description of Calden Camp and his particular purpose in it was specifically for that. He was not interested in the Grand War. And I'll leave you with this thought, and we'll pick this up later. There was one passage in his testimony where he is quoted as saying, one of this is killing people in the market and via the linguist and start a war race. And then the person responded back to him, who's called the president of the tribunal, you mean a race war? Or he says, quote, a race war. Okay. And he inverted it from a war race to a race war. A war race in that context would likely be that now, like the way we would describe our old Cold War, an arms acceleration. Not a race war as in black and white fighting in the streets. And these nuances and interpretation and understanding the narrative and reading his diary and interrogating him, these count. No wonder our story is completely wrong.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I hadn't given much thought to that. But I think that, you know, that's why it's very important to carefully, you know, when you read things or read some of his statements and certainly look at his diaries and anything that's out there, it's important to read it very carefully because, you know, something like that, as you just said, may pop out.
Jason Leopold from the truthout.org website, blog, and public record, I want to thank you for being us. You're doing great journalism over there.
Thanks so much, Chris.
We also want to make sure people support your blog, so donate and support independent journalism.